Hey guys, welcome to episode 14 of the Mysterious Benedict Society Read Aloud Podcast, Book 4. Today we'll be reading chapter 14, but first a recap of chapter 13. So the children are on a mission to go help Mr. Benedict cure poison that he is drinking, which is exactly what Mr. Curtin wants them to do, for he believes this is the key to help himself escape his prison. The children currently are driving in a station wagon with Kate at the wheel, who, by the way, is trying extremely hard not to be reckless and drive normally, to the place where the prison happens to be located, No Man's Land Island. So that's the end of the summary, guys, but before we start today's episode, I don't currently have any shoutouts, but I wanted to ask all of you, if you could, to leave a review if you are enjoying the podcast. I really don't want to be one of those people who ask for reviews all the time, and if you've been listening for a while, you know that I don't. Also, thank you for listening. But anyways, I just want this series to reach as many people as possible, so everyone can enjoy these phenomenal books. Okay, that's about it, so enough of the review talk, and I hope you enjoy the episode. Chapter 14, Where One Draws the Line. Much had happened in the year since the members of the Society had made their fateful trip to No Man's Land Island, where they had enrolled as students at the Learning Institute for the Very Enlightened, LIVE for short. And as secret agents for Mr. Benedict foiled Mr. Curtin's plot to improve the world with the help of his horrifying mind control invention, the Whisperer. In the aftermath of that desperate adventure, the island had been evacuated. Bewildered students were reunited with their families, and those without families, there were many of these, were found good homes. Mr. Benedict, of course, had devoted himself to helping the BrainSwap helpers, while several of Mr. Curtin's former employees, those executives and recruiters who hadn't managed to escape with him, faced varying degrees of justice and therapy. No Man's Land, for its part, became the subject of government squabbles. The rocky, hilly, unapproachable island in Stonetown Harbor had belonged to Mr. Curtin, as had the massive stone buildings of the Institute. Thanks to Mr. Benedict and his associates, the Institute's tidal turbines, yet another of Curtin's inventions, had eventually been repurposed to provide much of Stonetown with inexpensive electricity. But for a long time, the island had remained abandoned, for no one with any government authority could agree on what to do with it. That is, until Mr. Benedict had begun to apply his considerable powers of persuasion. For many reasons, he argued, his genius brothers should not be held in the Citadel along with the Tin Men. The Citadel in Brig City was the most secure facility in the region, and all extremely dangerous criminals were sentenced to incarceration here. Although a breakout had been deemed impossible by the authorities, Mr. Benedict nonetheless convinced them that to keep both the brains and the brawn of Mr. Curtin's wicked synodict in the same location, to afford any chance of collaboration and plotting, would be to court disaster. As it so happened, Mr. Benedict had the perfect solution to offer. Surrounded by water and treacherous shoals, connected to the mainland only by a single narrow bridge, No Man's Land Island was already notoriously inaccessible. With certain renovations and additional layers of security, all designed and overseen by Mr. Benedict himself, the Institute could become the most high security of high security facilities at a very little cost. The solution was accepted, the arrangements were made, and the work was begun. The Institute was reborn as the key enclosure for enemies of the public, the Keep for short, and although one day it was a house of significant number of criminals, its first inmate, and at present its only inmate, was Mr. Lethodra Curtin. So it was that Mr. Curtin had become, quite literally, a prisoner in a prison of his own making. Renovations at the facility were ongoing, but Mr. Curtin's security suite had been completed right away, for Mr. Benedict had insisted that his brother be removed from the vicinity of the Tin Men as soon as possible. Thus, for over a year now, Mr. Benedict's weekly routine had included many hours overseeing and directing the modifications being implemented at the Keep. And during breaks and at the end of his workdays there, visiting his surly twin, often in the agreeable company of S. Cubidalian. So Mr. Benedict was right, Ty declared when all this had been explained. If Mr. Curtin had still been at the Citadel when the Tin Men escaped, they could have taken him with them right then. Fortunately, Mr. Benedict has a gift for predicting problems, Stucky said. He may not have been able to prevent all of this mess we're in, but it certainly could have been worse. Ty frowned. But if the Keep was so inaccessible, Ty continued, then how are we going to give Mr. Benedict the serum he needs? Is he just going to let us in? As for that, said Rennie from the front, Mr. Benedict's security contracts prevented him from telling us much about the facility, but we know he wouldn't be allowed to just wander about the place right now, not when the baker's dozen are threatening an assault. And Mr. Curtin's letter confirms that. To remain behind with Mr. Curtin, Mr. Benedict has to be locked in the security suite with his brother. There's a small protected visitor's area with a sofa and a little pantry for Mr. Benedict and a bathroom and such. Mr. Benedict can't get out of there unless someone lets him out. So no, he can't just open the front door for us. Besides, McCracken will have men posted on the lookout. If we show up at the bridge gate, we'd be snatched away before we could even announce ourselves. Then how are we? And that's enough questions for now, Ty, Kate said cheerfully. It's better you don't know just yet. Well, said Ty with a shrug, Constance knows, but she's trying to keep it from me. I'm trying not to think about it at all, Constance growled from behind her hair, for 100 reasons, but not least because I'm trying to keep her from getting a whiff of it. So stop trying to figure it out, Ty. I'm not trying. It's like your thoughts are pushing mine down. It makes me notice. How about we give you something else to think about, Rennie suggested. Ty brightened. Okay, will you tell me stories about your adventures? Thus began a long stretch of storytelling, with Rennie, Kate, and Sticky taking turns, freely interrupting each other whenever the occasion suited. They spoke of their travels across the ocean, of their many narrow escapes, of all the clues, puzzles, and riddles they'd solved together. They spoke of their encounters with the Tin Men, downplaying and more frightening aspects of emphasizing their successes. And they spoke of the many projects they'd worked on together and less dangerous times, with special attention paid to the comical mishaps. I thought we'd never get the orangutan out of the kitchen, Rennie was saying when Ty, who had been giggling nonstop, abruptly lowered his head and fell asleep. That's my cue, said Constance, who had been silent for the last hour. She leaned her head against the door. Wake me up when he wakes up. Feel free to keep enjoying story time, she muttered, and in a moment was fast asleep herself. Kate, Sticky, and Rennie looked around at one another with all the same wistful expressions. It had been great fun reminiscing about their times together, and they would have gone on quite a while longer if Ty had stayed awake. But now no one wished to wake him, and in silence they returned to their individual thoughts as the station wagon rolled on. They drove past a number of small towns as well as a few large towns that used to be small. In between the towns was endless farm country, field after field of young crops that would grow and grow, eventually be harvested, and finally be replaced with different crops the following season. Rennie, without meaning to, kept thinking the same things. A town is still a town, even if it's a bigger town. A field is still a field, even if the crop is different. Friends are still friends, even if their circumstances change. All of these things seem true, yet at the same time all seem mysterious. No matter how much you know, he thought, there's always more that you don't. We're almost there, Kate said. She pointed to a sign ahead, unreadable to Rennie until they had drawn a good deal closer. Welcome to Pebbleton. In the back seat, Ty had awakened and nudged Constance in time for her to read the sign. Where is this? He whispered. My dad grew up here, Constance murmured. She yawned and rubbed her eyes. Well, he moved here when he was around my age. The day turned breezy, and on either side of the road, young green cornstalks shuddered and swayed. Cloud shadows raced across the fields. Kate drove slowly into the quiet town, turned right at the old train station, and drove slowly out of town again. They went down a winding country road, rounded some wooded hills, and at last came to a handsome old farmhouse. A few vehicles were parked in front of the house, but it was the vehicle behind the house, the one sitting in a cornfield, several walls of which appeared to have been plowed under to accommodate its presence there, that drew everyone's attention. For it isn't every day that one sees an airplane in a cornfield, even a modest single-engine airplane like this one. Even rarer, perhaps, is to know that one would soon be boarding that plane and flying off on a dangerous mission. Why here? Constance asked as Kate parked the station wagon. Why not at an airport? Too much communication between airports, Rennie said. Too many records of the flights coming and going. Rhonda suggested that this would be the best place. Ty squeaked. Rhonda Kanzambe's here? And number two, said Constance, peering with narrowed eyes at the farmhouse. Sure enough, just then the front door opened wide and out strode Rhonda and number two. They were a sight for sore eyes, and what a sight they were. The slim, tall figure of number two, with her yellowish complexion, yellow flight suit, and rusty red hair, presented a striking contrast with Rhonda's coal-black skin and her long, lustrous braids and, to everyone's surprise, her bright blue blouse, looking as if she'd hidden a cantaloupe beneath it. She laughed and nodded as they all swarmed out of the car and rushed upon her, full of exclamations. It's true, it's true, Rhonda said, hugging everyone in turn. There's another little scientist on the way. I told you I was going to start a family, didn't I? Why are you all so surprised? It was a wonderful discovery on a very tiring day, and for a brief spell everyone felt almost as if there were simply a happy reunion and nothing more. Even number two, usually so brusque and nervous, kept glancing at Rhonda's belly, grinning and kissing Rhonda on the cheek. She had quick hugs and kisses for everyone else, too, of course, except for Ty Lai, to whom she quarterly extended her hand. May I have a hug and a kiss? Ty asked, looking sadly at her hand. Number two looked ready to cry at this. Of course, she declared, pulling the little boy close and kissing him on the head. I was going to surprise you all with a visit next week, if you can believe it, Rhonda told him. Talk about timing. This isn't exactly the way I was expecting to tell you that I was, well, expecting. Oh, I so wish the circumstances were different. But how is it that you're here? Constance asked number two. You were on the ship with everyone else. Oh, well, I thought you might need me, of course, number two said matter-of-factly, and Milligan had radioed to let me know which airport he landed the plane. So it was only a matter of Captain Nolan arranging a rendezvous with the cargo ship, then having myself smuggled into Stone Town in a shipment of bananas. I blended in rather well, as it happened, although the big spiders were a nuisance. And finally proceeding in disguise to the airport, where I hot-wired Milligan's plane, having first enraged the noise cancellation mechanism, and took off unnoticed into the darkness before dawn. I flew directly to Littleview to refuel, after which I simply sat and awaited word, which I received from Ritty within the hour, and now here I am. That's all? Constance asked. Number two blushed. Well, I didn't mean to make a big fuss about it. She's teasing you, Rhonda said, squeezing number two's arm. The farmhouse door opened again, and this time a man emerged. He was advancing in years, probably Mr. Benedict's age or older, and walked a bit stiffly. It was easy to tell he was a farmer from his jeans and work shirt, tanned arms and a face and a baseball cap that bore the words, I'm a farmer. Most of his face was obscured by a thick gray beard, but he had kind and intelligent eyes and a voice to match them. John Cole, he said, introducing himself with handshakes for everyone. I'm an old friend of Nicholas's. Your hat says you're a farmer, Ty declared. Does it now, said Mr. Cole, whipping the cap off his head to look at it. Why, so it does. He scratched his head bemusedly. His hair was a short tangle of gray, then laughed a great booming laugh and tugged the cap back on. I actually almost never wear this, but this seemed the right occasion. It was a gift from Nicholas years ago. His idea of a joke requires about three long stories and a leap of imagination to find it funny as he does. We'll save those for another time. Mr. Cole, said Ritty, did you really have to destroy part of your crop to help us? Now listen to me, son, said Mr. Cole in a serious tone. You needed an airstrip far away from prying eyes, and now you have one, and that's all you need to think about. I happen to know all about you, and it's an honor for me to stand here with young people such as yourselves, just as it's going to be an honor to have you at my table. I'm sure you need some food in your bellies as soon as possible. As for Nicholas Benedict, well, what can I say? I would plow my entire crop under and sell the farm, too, if that's what it took to help him, and that would be an honor, too. Mr. Cole was right. They were all very hungry, and soon they gathered at a long table making a meal of fresh bread, cheese, and garden vegetables. The food was plentiful and delicious, but still Mr. Cole apologized for its simplicity. His wife was a superior cook, he informed them, but she had taken their old border collie to the veterinarian and wouldn't be back until evening. Time is a riddle, is it not? The farmer mused, returning from the refrigerator with a jar of homemade raspberry jam. The last time I saw Nicholas, that ancient dog of ours, was a puppy, and you know what? I remember the two of us felt old then. So what does that make us now? He laughed and shook his head, and yet at the same time we both agreed that part of us still felt like boys we once were, like we hadn't changed a bit. And do you know what Nicholas said? I remember it plainly. He said that he doesn't believe we become different people as we age. No, he says he believes that we become more people. We're still the kids we were, but we're also the people who've lived all different ages since that time. A whole bunch of different people rolled up into one. That's how Nicholas sees it, and I can't say I disagree. How else to explain that sometimes I want to run and jump the way I used to, but can't anymore? Yet at the same time enjoy sitting with a cup of coffee and a newspaper in a way you couldn't have paid me to do as a boy. Well, it's a wonder. Mr. Cole apologized then for rambling on, but everyone assured him with no such apology was necessary. Indeed, his words could not have found more sympathetic ears. There were at least four people at his table who had only recently wondered at how very much like children they felt, while also feeling very much not like children. Where did one draw the lines? Well, according to this new theory Mr. Cole had shared, perhaps one never had to draw lines at all. One simply became more. I'm five, announced Ty, who evidently was picking up on everyone's thoughts. I think I'm still just one person, he said with a shrug. But that's okay, Mr. Cole. What's your dog's name? And may I please have some jam? Mr. Cole smiled at the jar was passed down the table. You may be amused to learn that my dog's name is Nicholas, he said. That's another joke that only gets really funny if you know a few stories. I already think it's funny, Ty declared, and he popped a spoonful of raspberry jam directly into his mouth. At last the time had come to do a few walkthroughs, as Kate called them, and everyone headed out into the cornfield. They wouldn't be leaving until just before dark, which, according to Kate, gave them more than enough time to practice. Practice what? Ty wanted to know. Kate hesitated, but Constance rolled her eyes and said, I've got it covered, Kate. She's not going to find out. Find out what? Ty asked as Sticky gave him a lift to the plane's open doorway. Hey, he called out, moving farther inside. There are three more parachutes in here. Well, how about that? Kate said. She started with Rennie showing him how to climb out into a metal step attached to the wing, where to place his hands on the wing strut, how to jump off properly, and arch his back. The effort was minimal, but Rennie found himself sweating nonetheless. Sticky's experience was much the same. The idea of jumping backward not onto a bunch of flattened corn stalks, but rather into an empty space of thousands of feet above the ground was, to say the least, disconcerting. But it was impossible to land a plane on No Man's Island, and if they were to arrive there in secret, parachuting was their only option. "Okay," Kate said to Rennie when Sticky had done his walkthrough. "Let's practice it again." "What about me?" Constance asked with a frown that immediately transformed to a furious scowl as she realized the truth. "Wait! You're planning to go without me? No way! No, no, no!" Muttering softly about seeing to the dishes, Mr. Cole discreetly withdrew to the farmhouse. "How can you possibly think you'll go without me?" Constance shouted. "How can you? You need me! You may not think you do, but you do!" "Of course we could use you," Rennie said as calmly as he could. "Of course. But I promised Mr. Benedict to keep you safe, didn't I? And we're older than you are. We're responsible for you." "Why can't I be responsible for you?" Constance interrupted. "Who gets to say? Why do you get to say?"
We're older, Constance," Sticky tried. "A lot older, right? And the older you get, the more responsibility."
"I was part of the team when I was 2, Constance shouted, crying now. "I helped save the world when I was 2.
"You did," Kate said soothingly. "Of course you did. But we didn't have a choice then. The situation was different. This time..."
Natai was crying too, wailing actually and clinging to Constance's arm. Constance snarled. "This time you think you can do it without me? That's what you think?" Rennie started to touch her shoulder, saw the look in her eyes, and withdrew his hand. "We just think that we should try," he said, speaking up to be heard over Ty's wailing. "Think about it. McCracken would love nothing better than to get his hands on you, Constance. The rest of us, sure, he'd be laid to hurt us if it was convenient. But you? Who knows what lengths he could go through if he could get at you?"
"He won't," Constance said, wiping at her eyes. She glared at Rennie. "I won't let him. Believe me."
"Believe her," Ty sobbed. Rennie grimaced. He gestured at Ty and said quietly, "But you have to keep him with you to keep him safe, right?"
"I can come too," Ty howled.
"He can come too," Constance said, "and I will make sure to keep him safe. This is the way it has to be."
Rhonda and number 2 had been standing back, obedient with looks of great concern, started shaking their heads at the same time. Constance whirled on them.
"Don't even start," she said. "I happen to know that there is a much better chance of saving Dad if I'm part of the mission. So here's how it's going to be. Either Ty and I come along, making promises to be extra careful or whatever, or I will cling to the landing near gear of this plane, and if you try to pull me off, I will scream and bite and kick. If that doesn't work, I'll make you change your minds, even if it makes me sicker than I've ever been. Do you all understand? You are not going without me, and that is final."
Everyone was quiet except for Ty. His wails had subsided in loud sniffles. Constance was too angry to comfort him much, but she patted him a few times on the back and waited, looking around at everyone, meeting everyone's anxious eyes.
Kate sighed. "Well, come on then, Connie girl, let's do your first walkthrough." There was obviously no need for further discussion. Constance and Ty were going along. As Kate went through the routine with Constance, Sticky drew Rhonda aside to ask her a chemical question, and the two stood apart from the rest of the group, talking with furrowed brows. Rhonda gave the occasional nod, and at length she clapped Sticky on the shoulder. He looked relieved and gratified.
"That means a lot coming from you," he was saying as they rejoined the group, to which Rhonda replied that if the shoes were on the other feet, she could say the same thing to him.
"Also," Rhonda said, "I must say I love your new spectacles. I don't want to embarrass you, but you look so stylish. You've really become quite handsome, haven't you?"
"Uh-oh, Rhonda, you did embarrass him," Ty chirped.
He had quickly recovered from the earlier upset and seemed thrilled that everyone was getting along again.
"Oh, dear," said Rhonda, "my apologies. It's George now, right? My apologies, George. Now, Ty, why don't you come along and help me fetch the flight suits for my car? I have one for everybody, even you."
"Yay," said Ty, "but why would you have one for me if you didn't think I was going on the mission?"
"If there is one thing I learned from Mr. Benedict," Rhonda said, slipping her arm over her shoulders, "it's always to be prepared for every possibility."
Indeed, Rhonda had arrived in such an astonishing state of preparation that she might have been planning for months rather than hours. The parachutes had been inspected and re-inspected, the black flight suits were perfect fits for everyone, and the 3 walkie-talkies she gave them in the event that they had to split up or got separated were sophisticated and completely secure.
"They automatically switch to different frequencies at the first hint of intrusion," Rhonda said, "so you don't have to worry about anyone listening in."
Constance rolled her eyes. "That's not exactly true for all of us, you know."
Rhonda went to Constance and wrapped her arms around her. "I do know that," she said softly, "and I know that you're a brave, brave girl."
Constance stood glowering for a moment, then she leaned into the hug. By the time evening began to settle in, the society had been through their routines multiple times. As Kate had explained it, some of them would be tandem jumping, which involved being buckled to another person and sharing the same parachute.
Ty naturally would be buckled to Kate, and when Kate insisted that Constance also be buckled to someone, Constance insisted that it be sticky. "That way, if he passes out or freezes up," Constance explained, "I can be there to pull the ripcord so he doesn't die." "I'm not going to pass out or freeze up," Sticky snapped indignantly. "I don't do that anymore, and you know it."
"I hope not," Constance muttered loudly enough for everyone to hear.
Rennie would be on his own, and the duffel bag full of supplies would get its own parachute, which Kate would be arranged to deploy when she tossed it from the plane. Ty was particularly delighted about this for some reason and kept saying, "I'm the bag," and then pretending to be the duffel bag, stretching out his arms, swaying back and forth and saying nothing. Just before they boarded the plane, Rennie took Constance aside. She came reluctantly, a resentful look on her face that she seemed determined not to lose. "I don't want to hear it," she said. "Well, I'm going to say the words," Rennie said, "and you can choose to hear them or not." Constance crossed her arms, averted her eyes, and waited. "You're right that we have a better chance of succeeding with you along," Rennie said. "Every one of us believes that, and this is a scary thing that we are going to do without you, so please consider what this means."
"Why don't you tell me what it means?" Constance snipped. "I'm all out of considering."
"It just means that we care about you," Rennie said. He hesitated. He needed to be careful about what he revealed and didn't reveal to Constance.
"I guess that's it," he said at length. "That's the only reason we were planning to go without you, for what it's worth."
"You think I didn't know that?" Constance said, giving him a cutting look. She shook her head and stalked away. Rennie sighed. "It's all so easy," he muttered, and followed after her. Number 2 had already said goodbye to Rhonda and Mr. Cole and climbed into the cockpit of the plane. Now everyone else said their farewells, promising to be careful, promising they would all laugh together again on this other side of things, whatever and whenever that might be. One by one, the society members and Ty Lai boarded the plane. Kate secured the door. They all waved. Rhonda, wiping her tears from her eyes, raised one hand and held it aloft. Mr. Cole took off his cap and held it over his heart. "Everyone ready back there?" Number 2 called from the cockpit. Everyone was. "I'm engaging silent mode until we're clear of this area," Number 2 said. "We can talk again at 10,000 feet. She flipped a switch and the world went quiet. Ty's mouth opened, but no sound came out. In silence, the plane's propeller began to turn, slowly at first, then faster and faster until it was a blurred circle. The wind from the propeller caused Rhonda's braids to fly about her face. She secured them with her hands, all in perfect silence. Mr. Cole's cap got away from him and sailed silently over the young corn. The plane began to move, turning silently around in a circle. Mr. Cole had plowed for that purpose until it faced the corn line runway. They could feel a trembling in everything that grew stronger as Number 2 accelerated and the plane bucked forward. They looked out their windows as the corn stalks moved silently past, faster and faster until they were a wave of green and gold. And just before the plane reached the end of the field, they felt themselves rising up and up over the silent farmhouse, over the silent hills, and up into the great silent sky.